The following interview was conducted for the Yachting Oral History Project of Mystic Seaport Museum, Incorporated. The narrator is Mr. P. James Roosevelt. The interviewers are Fred Calabretta and John Rumanier. The interview took place at Mystic Seaport Museum on February 24th, 1989.
00 seconds.
Okay, we should be all set. Just to begin, I thought I'd ask you about Sewanaka's role in international competition, British America Cup and Sewanaka Cup, and how sort of your ideas about how that developed and maybe what the club did to encourage it or promote it.
Well, come tomorrow and you'll hear it all. Of course, I wasn't alive then, but I mean, I'm up to date on it. And what happened was that some of our Americans made contact with the Brits during the First World War, and guys like Paul Hammond served in some sort of a navy that included both Brits and Americans in it. And under those circumstances, you know, you form close friendships under adversity. And then in 1920, after the First World War, there was an America's Cup event at which some of those friendships were renewed. And particularly Hammond was, I guess, really the driving force behind the concept of getting friendly competition between America and England started. And the idea was to sail in small boats in a team race, which was a new concept to the British, not to us, and four boats to a side, and using their rule, the international rule over there, and our rule, the universal rule over here, and six races, cumulative score, and the first club to win the thing twice in succession wins it. So that's there was tremendous interest. I mean, it's hard for us to believe, and it's certainly hard for me to create in words, apparently, the amount of interest. Evidently, yachting was about to disappear in England after the First World War. True. And all of the types, I mean, guys like William Burton, who had been helmsman of the Shamrock, was in on this. And a lot of big daddies on our side. And so that got the team race thing going. And then when it did come time for the British to come over here, they insisted that we stick with 6 meters. And in a sporting gesture, as we like to say, we acquiesced. And after that 1922 series was over, one of their slippery boats, a Scottish boat, went up to Manchester and won Challenge 4 and won the Sewanaka Cup. So now you have team racing and match racing. And then in 1926, Swede Whiten won the Gold Cup for America for the first time. So now you have fleet racing, team racing, and match racing. So now, and all in the 6 meter class, and all for, by now, prestigious stuff. So now the thing is going. And we started clearly, I mean, the show tomorrow will show you clearly, we were inept in design and really in sail handling to begin with, and to begin with is 1921, but by 1932, with the invention and perfection of the parachute spinnaker, we had achieved ascendancy in design and in sail handling and in tactics, at least as far as the British were concerned, and probably really as far as anyone else was concerned. And so there wasn't anything else. There wasn't, you know, Olympics were, I mean, I can remember personally not going to the Olympics because why bother to go to them? I mean, that was not where it was at. And in the 20s and 30s, where it was at is quite evidently the 6 meter class. So young guys who would go to Olympics today went to that then. So you had a lot of big name players racing 6 meter boats. They were not big names while they were racing on this. Only in retrospect, you look back. I think the perspective has to be that you know, it was attracting the guys who wanted to be at the leading edge of the sport.
But how did Sewanaka? It was always Sewanaka at the center.
It was always Sewanaka, yeah. For America, translate Sewanaka.
No, the Shieldses belonged to Sewanaka, and Briggs Cunningham belonged to Sewanaka, and all these guys from other parts of the Sound and from New England.
They had to, because because the British American series was organized by Rear Commodore Paul Hammond and Commodore Percy Chubb, and that started it. And then Sewanaka was the challenging club for the Sewanaka Cup, and then a Sewanaka member, all for Terrible to be sure, won the Gold Cup. So that tended to keep it in Sewanaka, and the management of Sewanaka was bright enough, coercive enough, or whatever, to say, you know, if you want to race on our team, all you got to do is join our club. Non-resident membership is not expensive, and even resident membership wasn't terribly expensive. So I remember I met many years later, I met a guy who had come all the way on from St. Louis in the 20s to be in on this action. And had joined Sewanaka. He stayed joined for many, many years. And he didn't see that there was anything unusual about joining Sewanaka. The unusual part was he was up against the Eastern establishment. He knew that. And he knew that was going to happen. And he knew that was different. And it was different. It was fun to see it through his perspective.
How much of an obstacle would it have been for him or for another sailor from New England, for example, to...
Well, we were pretty good about the New England types, I think. The guy from St. Louis definitely felt prejudiced and discriminated against, and I think he was. I mean, he told me enough so that I would have to agree with him. I mean, the other thing that has sort of come across to me out of this, and this is obviously an opinion, and maybe not everybody shares it, but looking at this stuff, this was when there was an establishment. And the establishment had this game pretty well ordered to suit the way they wanted it. And they were pretty good guys, so there really wasn't that much to bitch about. But if for some reason you didn't happen to make it into the establishment, you didn't make it in.
So even when I was a kid in the 60s, in the late 50s, if you were going to be a honcho at Sewanaka, you had to join the New York Yacht Club. So there was this connection there. And Sewanaka, going back to when it was founded in the 1870s, it was kind of the small boat amateur wing of the New York Yacht Club. So there was this interchange there. And New York Yacht Club was the national establishment club until very recently.
Yeah. Well, but I think going back earlier, I think Sewanaka had always been competitive with the New York Yacht Club. It is true that many of our Commodores then went on to be Commodores at the New York Yacht Club.
But
it was maybe a training ground.
There's this maverick. See, there was a maverick inside the establishment. There was this character called Sweet Whiten.
Yeah.
And we had to tell some stories about Sweet Whiten.
You mentioned him the last time we spoke. And mentioned
did you talk much about him?
No, you just mentioned that he was a controversial figure, and I had it here in my notes to ask you to comment on that. But.
Well, he was the... It happens that he was a genius, probably, is probably the best way to describe him. His middle name was Frash, and he inherited the Frash sulfur fortune. He became president of the Union Sulfur Company, I guess now Union Oil. And he was obviously very well endowed financially. He played the piano and wrote music. He designed winning 6 meters. I mean, the man was tremendously capable. He had... Obviously, he was older than I was, so I don't know how he was brought up, but I do know that the story was around that he was sent off to boarding school in a Lord Fauntleroy outfit. And he, when he came into the six-meter picture, I guess abrasive is probably the word we'd use today. In fact, one of the paid hands on the 6 meters earned his way to immortality by turning to somebody and saying, you know, Mr. Whiten, he's not only a son of a bitch, but he's a son of a bitch. And so, anyway, my father was one of the few people who got along with Swede, and Swede liked him, and I had, therefore, kind of an introduction. I got on crewing with him, and I pointed out to him one time that we'd never lost a race when I crewed with him. Was true at that point, and that clicked into his head, so I remain high on his list for years.
Was he easy to crew for?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, no, I mean, he just, you know, he had his own opinions. He wanted to do things his way, but...
he had, I crewed for him in the 60s, in 5.5s, in one whole season in the summer in International One Designs, which was then he'd lost one eye, and he had bursitis in one arm, so he had a one-eyed, one-armed skipper. And one of his opinions, prejudices, was that before he'd won the Gold Cup, when he was very young, they'd been in eliminations for a Salonika Cup, and he hadn't been chosen.
Right.
Ray Hunt had been chosen.
No, well,
somebody.
No, it wasn't Ray, but it
Charlie
was.
Charlie Adams, or?
I'm trying to remember who it was. But it is true that they...
He hadn't been chosen because they
selected his boat.
Yeah, they put somebody else
in. Somebody else in to steer it.
They didn't trust him. They thought he was a bit unreliable. So since then...
Because he was young. He was just fresh out of college. In other words, it was some legitimacy to their thing, but it was arbitrary.
But the lesson he drew from it was not that young people should earn their way, but that you shouldn't trust a committee. And as a result, he never would put the... When I sailed him, he would never, ever get the boat in a position where there might be a protest, because he was dead sure that the protest would go against him, which meant we always started at the wrong end of the starting line. And we would beat up at Larchmont, when it blows out of the southwest, you beat up, and you meant to go way over towards Execution Rocks. Tack across, we'd go way over Thames Grove, Glen Cove, and tack across, and we get to the weather mark about 13th, every time. And we get to the weather mark with a bunch of boats, and we'd sail way up around everybody. And we'd sail down, you know, down off the hospital, and then we'd be maybe about 7th at the jibe mark, and then we'd go across Long Island Sound, we'd be about 3rd at the leeward mark off of Rye. And then we would beat back, and it would be a slam-bang battle all the way back with two other boats, and half the time we won.
Well, there was an event just shortly before the time Johnny's talking about. I'm trying to get it in my head, but it was an important series, and he did get involved in a protest, and he had the paint of the other boat on the side of his boat to prove where contact was made.
Oh.
And the decision was decided against him.
That may be what I'm
confirming.
Yeah,
what you're suspicion. Talking about. And he, of course, he flew into orbit. How could you possibly decide that when you knew where we hit and so on and so forth? I was a little mystified by that decision, too. But I knew the committee, you know, when people... It's more than just the place you contacted to determine who's right or wrong in a protest often.
He was rather very rigid. Things were this way or that way. Late in his life, he lived on Glen Cove in Oyster Bay, on Cove Neck, right up the street from Jimmy's. And we would go up there in the morning and get there about 9:30 in the morning on a Saturday morning and get a big powerboat. And we'd tow his International One Design down to Larchmont. It's about a 3-hour tow. Emmy, was that his wife's name?
Well,
Emmy's
that was
daughter.
For a while.
Second wife.
Yeah, Emmy was the first.
No, the second.
It'll come to me in
a second. Yeah, talking the whole time.
Yeah.
And we get down there and we pile off the boat and we go sailing and we do this magic trick every day going from 13th to 2nd. And we pile on the boat and come back and drinking all the way back to his house. Then we kind of pour off the boat and come back. And on Sunday morning, we repeat the whole process. We go on. And after a while, I got to know them quite well, and he had odd things on board. He had little cushions with all these odd initials of Scandinavian yacht clubs. And he became known as Swede because of his connections.
When he won the Gold Cup in 1926. He was at college. He was fresh out of college, and he took college kids with him, one of whom had never raced on a boat before. And he took this boat, which had made the team, the Scandinavian-American Cup team the year before, 13, but which he had not been allowed to go on. And he took it over to the Baltic, and he won the Gold Cup against world-class sailors. And then we were unable to defend the Gold Cup or win it back until a decade later, in 1936, when he went over and did the same thing with Indian Scout, which was his own design. It was a fantastic boat.
Funny looking keel.
So he earned the nickname Swede as a result of that. Actually, the victories were in Norway, but the way thing is. And we used to race down in Texas against the Fays, who were buddies of his, and he got them involved in 5-meter sailing and stuff like that. So to keep it going, he'd take a whole bunch of us down there, and we'd team race with these guys.
Yeah. And
great guys, too. And of course, they would call it, you know, with that amazing Houston accent. They call him Swede. Hey, Swede! That was kind of funny.
So he had the political, he had joined every, he had made an honorary member of every royal yacht club in Scandinavia.
Yeah.
And he had a little cushion for each one.
Yeah.
And he informed me one day that he'd quit all his royal clubs, he said, because monarchies caused communism.
He was, yeah, his political views were extreme, too. I mean, in other words, he was definitely a Democrat among a Republican establishment. Yeah. I think he enjoyed that kind of thing. He was on some peace commission down there in Princeton. We had Oppenheimer on it and stuff like that. When he'd get going on what the solutions for the world's problems were, they were pretty wild.
But he would raise hell. The real problem was that Salonika was, is that there'd be times of peace and there'd be times when Swede was upset about something, which often were things that nobody else noticed.
1530?
Right.
And he would quit the club.
Right. Yeah, he quit more times.
Talk about peace commissions. And they'd send off a peace commission.
Right.
Was he well-liked, or were people leery of him at Salonika?
Well, that's it. No, I mean, he was, I guess you'd say scratchy would be the way to put it. And I don't know that he got close to people much. I think in some ways I might have been as close to him as anybody at a point in his 16? Life for 2 or 3 years in there.
But it was a place that had a lot of eccentrics at it.
Yeah, it always have. I mean, but sailing does, and particularly if you've got world-class sailors, I mean, they're very opinionated, and they sure know what's right, and that's the way they're going to do it, and he can do it his way, or maybe he can't. But I'm going to do it my way. I mean, I organized some teams to go over and race against Scotland for the BA Cup after, you know, long after.
1630?
And you would think even, you know, in this decade, this era, when people presumably know how to behave themselves, and you couldn't even get them all on the same charter flight, even offering a price discount. That just wasn't going to fly.
But Salonika, my sense of it still is that it was a funny mix of very conservative areas nearby, Cold Spring Harbor and such, and then there was a kind of a semi-jet-setty crowd, the Locust Valley crowd, and a lot of New York money, weekend, and a lot of local people, like the Roosevelts.
Yeah.
And so you had this combination of people being thrown together. Then you threw them into this very unusual kind of racing, which you don't see much anymore, this Challenge Cup kind of racing. Which I'm convinced is, you know, the America's Cup is the height of it, and which brings out real characters.
Yeah.
Where did somebody like Clinton Crane fit in as far as his
personality? Well, he was the generation before. And he was cut from the same mold. I mean, you can look at Swede or Clinton or anybody like that. There are two sides to every coin. And certainly one of the things is that Salonika was founded for amateur sailors, and the concept was that we were supposed to know how to sail our own boats, navigate our own boats, and design our own boats. And amazingly enough, that concept carried right on down from founding, right on through actually to the 50s, because Crane was the president of the National Lead Company, and he only designed boats as a sort of a hobby, an amateur. He did it for friends. Yes, he charged a fee. Yes, he designed a great many of them, but I mean, that was not his business. He was an extremely meticulous guy, another one of these people who was kind of cold and aloof. You would even say a little bit keen on himself. So again, you don't see him surrounded by a bundle of friends all having a great time like you would with a Bob Meyer or even a Sherman Hoyt. But his contributions were fabulous to this business. I mean, he lost the Salonika Cup in 1896, the second time it was sailed for, and he challenged several times after 19. That, designed the boats for it, and nothing happened. And it would be almost 30 years later, in 1925, he designed the first 6-meter that won the Salonika Cup for Salonika. And even there, he let Sherman steer it. So it wasn't until 28 that he personally steered a Salonika Cup winner. Well, there's, 32 years of campaigning unsuccessfully for a Salonika Cup. That's quite, I mean, the guy was persistent. I remember when he was getting close to dying, he had an automobile accident or something. Anyway, he was laid up in the hospital with all kinds of casts and whatnot. My old man went to visit him and came back and reported that he had designed various apparatus so that he could move himself around in the hospital, even in all kinds of a cast. Again, a very inventive mind.
Did he spend much time at the club in the years before his death?
He was a commodore there, and he was around involved in this racing. And point of fact, his house was in the Cold Spring Harbor area, and he tended to keep his boats down there. You'd think of him maybe as more of a Cold Spring member than a Salonica member in that sense. But in the sense of leading the charge when it came to international racing, he was very much involved. He was not involved
2030
with this BA Cup thing to begin with, but he got into it very quickly. He designed a boat in 1922, which was a failure. It was 13-6s designed by 13 different designers, and his was a cluck. And that, there must have been that kind of thing in his makeup that kicked off competitive juices, and he just was stuck with it until he was the leading designer in the class.
Was he as popular among the membership as some of the characters like Sherman Hoyt?
That's what I'm saying. No. Yeah. No, I wouldn't think so. Because I wouldn't say he was unpopular, and he certainly was not controversial like Sweet or anything like that. I just say he was aloof. His book, he wrote his own reminiscences, which are pretty good, but I think you don't get sort of a warm personality coming through there.
He's not out drinking with the king. You know.
No. He doesn't mind Sherman out drinking. Considers that kind of amusing, but he's not involved in that.
Yeah. One thing you mentioned last time I thought was interesting, you talked about two generations of Salonica sailors going back to people like Hoyt and Crane and Hammond, and then sort of next generation with Bob Meyer and Briggs Cunningham and I guess Corny Shields and people like that.
22.
And I just wondered, in your opinion, what made those two groups or those two generations different? How were they different in their approach to sailing or to racing?
Well, the second generation had been taught by the first. And one of the differences, and this is an opinion I've just formed, so Johnny can correct me if he doesn't agree with it, but I was wondering, it occurred to me, why the hell did all of this die out? And it didn't, entirely. It's on the West Coast, and it's in Europe. 6 meters is still going, but they're not going in Oyster Bay. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One of them, of course, was the expense. But I think, in addition to that, the second generation never raised a third. Because if you say that Johnny and I are the third, we weren't attracted 6 meters and that kind of stuff as a perpetual game. We wanted to go with the one design classes. As far as we were concerned, that's where the action was, and that's where the good sailors were, and that's where we wanted, therefore, to be. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why this whole business just sort of wound up in Oyster Bay.
Well, there were 5.5s.
Yeah, but that.
And I was. How much? Young guy, I'm 45 now.
Yeah, well, I'm older than you.
Yeah, 15 years.
Yeah.
Because my dad, when you were young, you used to go over and do 6 meter regattas in Europe with my father. We used to
speak
to your father.
I
a little bit
remember that well.
And dad never was interested in it.
Yeah, no. Well, except that he did sail Jill with
it. No, but I mean, in the 30s he did, when he was in college.
Yeah.
But he remembered, he told me once that Lee Loomis came up to him and asked him if Loomis bought a 12-meter and did an America's Cup campaign. He just said this about 1960. Mm-hmm. Would he do it? He said no. Mm-hmm. He may have said it for a variety of reasons. He said no, and he made me promise that I'd never do it either.
Yeah.
He thought the whole thing was a waste of time and money.
Yeah.
He has a pretty strong social conscience, as do you, in different directions, I think, but the same concerns.
Yeah.
And it just seemed to him a terrible race. But I did, when I was 18 or 19, I did 5.5 meter racing, and we had it in the early 60s, but it didn't last for long.
No.
It lasted for a couple of summers, and three or four summers.
24-30?
No, it seemed to me, I got the sense, again, having seen the 30s through teenage eyes, that what we were doing after the war in the 50s with sixes until they died, and then with five fives until they died, was attempting to perpetuate something, but we weren't. I mean, we knew we didn't have the top class sailors in there. We had some wealthy men who wanted to throw money around.
Because the fays would turn up.
Yeah.
These two Texans, and they sailed sixes a little bit, and then they came up in 5.5 meters, and they were really good.
They were good. Damn good sailors.
They spent a lot of money, and they sailed all year round, among other things. Remember Ralph Fay? He said, every time I have to buy a new jib, I just wait for another little squirt of oil.
Right.
And then George O'Day would turn up.
Yeah.
Would step out of an International 14 and get in a 5.5 meter and clean everybody's clock.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. 25, 30. And George O'Day didn't want to join Salonica. There was no reason for him to join
up. No.
And you could lug boats around a lot quicker than you used to. So maybe that had something to do with it.
Yeah. No, I think that, I think there are a lot of different reasons. But, I mean, clearly the first generation, as it will, sold the second generation, as it were, on the excitement, on the competition, on the fun, the enthusiasm, the amateurism, and all that kind of thing. But the second generation somehow or other conveyed this point to the third generation, at least to Jimmy Rubenier.
And the war got in the way.
And the war, sure.
And life was a lot more expensive. Now, the interesting thing to me is after I left Salonica in the late 60s, before you came back, because you dropped out for a while, didn't you? You really didn't race for a long time.
I was out from 60 to 70, more or less, because I was raising kids.
Raising kids.
As a single parent.
Which is what I'm doing.
26-30?
Next year, I'm going to start sailing again. But
I wouldn't have come back, actually, except my kid.
Phil wanted to sail. Yeah.
And they weren't doing it right, so I thought I better.
But what I find interesting is in that generation, Phil and Arthur, my brother Arthur is Jimmy's youngest son's
oldest son,
friend, but he's the godfather.
He's the godfather of my youngest son.
And the but in that generation, there were three or four really first class world champion sailors: Stevie Benjamin and Gary Knapp.
Yeah, and I will confess that I swell with pride at that.
Something because that.
I was head of the junior committee when we were putting them through the junior club. Yeah. Everybody from Terry Knapp to
the Knapps.
Right.
And these were the Briggs Cunninghams of their generation.
Yeah.
Stevie Benjamin won a silver medal in 1984, and Gary Knapp's been on two Olympic teams now.
Yeah.
And real top level in the international classes.
Yeah.
So in the fourth
Stewie
generation
Neff was Stewie Neff would have been the Olympic entry in the thin class when Carter scrubbed the Olympics.
So, yes,
I think
that's right.
Fairly definite. And Terry Neff, his brother, won the Long Island Sound Junior Championships and came really pretty close to going all the way.
Was fifth in the Olympics in Arthur Cooling for in 76.
And won the youth, the first youth, yeah, first I guess year. They had. And they went from that age down to John Fullerton, who won some single-handed stuff. And then it went back to sleep.
But there was this next generation of kids, who, in a sense, picked up the ball and took up the challenge. So there may be some sort of cycle, and I bet you'll find this in almost every club that this happens. There was a cycle.
Well, there again, though, I think that we
Salonica
made a mistake there in not providing for these kids anything of value to them except an occasional contribution. And so they found no need to be members of Salonica or to have any connection. And of course, again, I mean, this is part of a national scene where yacht clubs become less and less necessary, or less and less connected with yachts and more connected with the restaurant.
29.
And but anyway, for whatever reason, you don't think of Salonica when you think of Stevie Benjamin, unless you happen to know.
To have known that,
Whereas you do think of Salonica when you think of Sherman Hoyt, for sure.
Sure.
How would you compare, the general attitude and atmosphere among the juniors in, say, the late 30s and, the present day or the more recent?
Well, again, the Pleon Yacht Club, I guess, was the first organized junior yacht club. There were always juniors in Oyster Bay, and they were always allowed, encouraged, whatever verb you want. to come and crew, race, clean up my boat, whatever. That generally was some competition that was provided for them during the week. But the Suwanee Yacht Club got a junior clubhouse up and built and incorporated and a regular membership going in 1936. And that same establishment that I was speaking of really put the pedal to the metal on that one and applied a lot of encouragement. And so that our junior club had over 200 members in 1942 and then closed in 1943 because the instructors were gone, the war was on, and all of that stuff. When we opened after the war, we had maybe as many as 30 members. And the attitude had completely changed. In other words, what do we want the kids around here for? You know, who needs them? So I guess Johnny's right on that one, too, the cycles of that. What then happened is the juniors who came through the junior club became influential out of all proportion to the rest of the membership and much more interested in yachting and sailing. And so they all got on the board of trustees, and then once they were on the board, mm-hmm. then the junior club could have whatever it wanted again.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
You and Nath and Harry. The Loonies had come and gone, yeah. But Harry and, yeah. One thing about Salonika I remember was that you always were sailing very racy boats.
3130.
When you weren't sailing 6 meters, you had Ravens,
yeah.
Which were these fantastic.
Oh, those were the greatest. But that, and again, that was sort of a, you know, that was a group of young men who wanted to buck the establishment,
yeah.
Really. And as a matter of fact, there's some correspondence I just turned over, which reminded me of something, you know, as the sixes and the five fives died out, the Swede could see what was coming. He wanted
32.
To perpetuate the racing that he'd known and liked, and he had an idea that we could make the Raven into an open design class.
Huh.
And, of course, it never got very far. It didn't get far enough that we took the plans, they took the lines off the Raven, and we talked about it a lot, but I guess the British were dead set against the centerboard boat, so... So that was
you know what a Raven is?
Yeah.
Do you still have yours in your garage?
No, yeah. No. I kept it for quite a long while because it had
30?
Provided a lot of fun, and then it was falling apart, and I wanted to get rid of it. And there was a guy who knew that I couldn't have been that good. It had to be the boat, and he had to buy the boat. And so he bought the boat.
I ran into him in St. Louis, in fact.
Yeah.
In a little lake east of St. Louis, there was a bunch of Ravens about 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, they still have them down on the South Shore. They changed them a little bit, not much. They still are.
33?
I've never quite understood why the class never really caught on. They were, I guess, among the biggest and fastest one-design planing boats ever. And they were pinched in too much at the stern. So they, when you did really have an out-of-control feel to them. Which was a little scary to some people, and they appealed immensely to guys who knew nothing about sailing forever, and would get in them and make the most horrible spectacle of how not to sail, and that would convince the old folks to stay out.
They looked like battleships.
Yeah. They weren't very pretty looking, more like a Rhodes 19, I guess. They had no overhangs to speak of, and a big main, a small jib. We're supposed to be able to roll a reef the main. That was the theory, but we never did because the roller reefing really never worked. But gosh, they were fast.
Yeah,
they were a lot of fun. They made a 5.5. I mean, you know, they started us on the same gun.
Yeah.
The first year, the 5.5s were up. And, I mean, upwind and light air, which was not supposed to be our stuff. I mean, we'd leave those guys way behind.
Yeah.
Weather leg.
Hmm.
And then down at Larchmont, they'd start us 15 minutes behind the Internationals, and the big game was, could we get around the course and beat the first International across the line? And we often tried.
34-30?
Yeah. And when would this have been, like the mid-50s?
It was started, yeah. Briggs Cunningham, again, brought them in. They were designed by a guy in Providence who I don't really think designed much to write home about before or since. And somehow or other, Briggs got a hold of one, and he painted it robin's egg blue, and he towed it down behind his lovely commuter towing boat and into Sawanaka. And I remember coming in and just watching that it made no wake at all. And then he allowed us to sail it in the Stratford Shoal overnight race, a 50-mile race, which a lot of real small boats used to race in, and which they can't now because of liability and all that jazz. But we did race it. We didn't know how to sail it, and we were learning how to sail it in the dark with nothing to compare against. But even so, we were first to finish. I think our handicap prevented us from winning, but we were impressed. So Harry, I was in college, and Harry Anderson was out of college, and Harry decided we needed a fleet, and yeah, we could get an order. We had, if we bought 8 of them with a quarter down, we could get some sort of fleet discount and have them all ready for next summer, which was going to be the summer of 50. And so Harry bought one and paid the full 36? price, and I bought one and paid the full price. So, and then Harry scurried around to get other guys to buy. And just before the next payment was due, we just at the last minute get somebody. We got Frank Snyder, for example, the current commodore of the New York Yacht Club. He was one who fell in just at the last minute. And we got my Uncle Jack, and we got, I got a few, Harry got most. And so then we had our fleet of 8 Ravens, which in 50 was a decent fleet. 20 boats on a line was considered too many in those days. So 50 was 8, I mean, was fine. And we did build it up more. And we did, I won a Nationals in 1953, in Sandusky, Ohio, on the Great Lakes, and I was swelled with pardonable pride because I think it was the first time a Sawanaka member had ever won a national championship in a one-design class. And, you know, so much for these open classes. And anyway, after that, Sawanaka boats dominated the Nationals. I ended up winning 3, Timmy won 3, and various other people won 1 national championship, I'm talking about, for quite a long while. And the fleet had, by this time, the class had grown to over a couple of hundred. At some point, we brought in fiberglass boats. I was very dubious as to whether they could race against plywood boats on equal terms. And I think we were a little overly concerned about that, so that the glass boats really weren't as good for a while. They finally got to be as good. And so that was pretty much the story on that one.
One thing, there had been...
38?
Did you sail Atlantics much?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was,
I sailed them for a couple of years.
Yeah, and that's... it was a junior boat.
Well, yeah, that was before the war.
Yeah.
The junior championships were raced at Atlantic's, and the midgets were raced
Star
in Stars.
Boat, 3 people.
Yeah, and I was a starboat crew.
Yeah.
I remember kicking the backstays back with my bare feet.
They didn't have centerboard. They had even the Wee Scott was a keel.
38,
yeah. There
30?
Were no centerboard boats.
Yeah. Yeah, no, because they didn't believe in boats that could capsize.
Yeah.
There was always this question about how should you train a junior? And on the one hand, you want to train him in a boat that'll capsize, but on the other hand, you don't, because that'll scare him, and it's too quick a response to his mistake. We want to train him in a stable boat. And I think it was out of that thinking that the Sawanaka Seabird was designed by Olin and taken up and tested out for this new junior club on one of the Finger Lakes in the middle of the winter and in a gale of wind. And the result of that testing was that they took some foot or I think 3 feet off the mast and one off the boom.
Rod comes in.
So you had really the most safe as a church boat for juniors, and a great boat, which again, because of the expense escalation of costs and everything, the juniors don't race it anymore. But the girls do. The ladies sailing still keep the Seabirds going. Not many of them, but enough of them.
Mrs. Schneider still has a couple
of them. Yeah, yeah. They were a great boat. We used to, in the wartime, we cruised around in those great overnight passages to Bayside and so on and so forth. The mothers pulling their hair out because they didn't know where the hell we were. There wasn't any gas. They couldn't find us. The Coast Guard wouldn't look for us. But the mothers, I guess, had more nerve than mothers do today.
Side two of the original recording begins here.
Points was is that you had very young people sailing pretty big boats.
Yeah.
And dad was a bit of a prodigy, I think, but he would go out at 14 or 15 with two other guys.
Maybe 30.
And they'd sail down to Larchmont.
Yeah.
In the Atlantic. And we used to do that in Blue Jays later on because we never believed in trailing. So we get in the Blue Jays single-handed down to Larchmont.
Yeah.
But he'd do that, and he'd go down, and then they got Larchmont Race, who could be over. Then they go to Pequot, so they'd go down to Pequot. Then they'd come back to Oyster Bay after a couple of weeks.
Yeah. We did the same. Of course, in the Ravens, it was easy. In fact, I remember going from the Larchmont Breakwater to the Center Island Bell in the Raven in 45
minutes. I bet you could.
I did.
41.
So that cut the commuting time down. I remember sailing all over the Sound one night with Harry Anderson, too. We went for drinks. We decided in the afternoon to go for drinks at the American Yacht Club, which we did. After they closed the bar, we decided there were some bars over in Hempstead that were probably still open. Went there, they weren't open. We came back to Oyster Bay.
When you get to the ice boat, guys, ask what they do in the evenings in the ice boats out on the lakes.
Yeah.
Their problem is they're always dodging the snowmobiles on the lakes. Yeah. But essentially, they're bar hopping on the ice boats.
Yeah. But, you see, boats were bigger. I mean, in other words, Lee Loomis was given a 12-meter while he was in Princeton to keep him off the street, so to speak. And it was not, as you say, maybe it's prodigious, but on the other hand, the scale was bigger. I mean, there were just plain bigger boats around. I mean, M boats, where ordinary people had M boats.
42.
12 meters weren't so huge in the late 30s. And even in the 40s, well, I mean, for example, we had these junior cruises out of the junior club, which we used to do on a combined basis with the beach club, and we'd go in 12 meters.
Yeah.
Junior cruises.
Mr. Millsmith.
Well, and Crane in Crane, and Bill Strawbridge in Matina, and all that
30.
Stuff. And
I think one of it sounds terrible, but one of the best things that ever happened to yachting with a capital Y was the Depression, which meant there were a lot of boat yards out there trying to keep a lot of people eating, which meant you could buy boats real cheap, dirt cheap.
Yeah.
And what a Doré, it's hard to compare in dollars because of inflation, but Doré didn't cost the Stevens as much more than $30,000 in 1929.
Well, my father bought Persephone, a Francis Harrishoff designed 40-foot boat, 55 overall, almost identical with Stormy Weather, from Bill Strawbridge. He chartered her for a season with an option to buy at $7,500. Now, I have just bought a Rosinante Ketch. What would this be? 30 years later, also designed by Francis Harrishoff, and I paid $8,000 for 21 feet in the water alone, 24 feet in the water alone. And of course, the dollar shrunk. I guess that's the principal thing. But the other thing is the difference between 1939, when we were still really basically in the Depression, and 1974.
So what was it like during the war?
Well, I've often thought, you know, there are an awful lot of guys my age who were pretty good sailors. You mentioned O'Day, Melgus is another, and so on and so forth. The Mossbackers are two more.
44.
Ted Hood is another. And why is this? Well, this is because there wasn't any gas. And as I say, mummies were braver or whatever. And there wasn't much for a kid to do. And there certainly wasn't any motorboat wake. So I spent all my life on the water.
Yeah.
I mean, I would sail all day
with
my buddies, and I would either single hand or not, or we'd cruise, or we'd race, or we'd get into trouble or missed it for something, but we were always sailing. And Ted Hood was doing the same thing in Marblehead. He was sailing perpetually and even living on the boat all summer long.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, you learn a little bit about one of the problems, one of the reasons I have a kid now, 16, who really isn't terribly interested in sailing. And one of the reasons why is there are too many more exciting
options. My kids aren't that interesting.
Yeah. 45? Yeah.
But now, could you go out on the Sound?
Yeah, we did. There was nothing to stop us.
Yeah.
We could go anywhere.
Yeah.
The only thing, the parents would try to say that the Coast Guard would stop us. And that was something of a threat. But they really wouldn't.
Yeah.
They had much more important things to do.
Have there been any really good sailors at Salonika that you can think of who have been overlooked, 30? Or whose names maybe don't appear on the record as often as they should, or people who haven't gotten the recognition they deserve, say going back to the 30s?
Garland.
Yeah, Garland, perhaps. Frederick Remington was another. Duncan Sterling, perhaps. Up in your end of the harbor, Dave Noyes, I can tell recently.
Boy. See, but do you know the geography? What were the area we're talking about?
46.
I can't exactly.
Well, it's a funny center. Here's this harbor called Cold Spring Harbor. Here's Stamford on the other side of Long Island Sound. So we're about 35 miles east of New York, 30 miles east of New York. And here's this very deep harbor called Cold Spring Harbor that goes out to the Sound. Here's the Sound. And here is Cove Neck. Cold Spring Harbor here goes in about 3 miles. And then out here is an island. Right here, connected to the mainland by a causeway over to Long Island.
46,
and that's called Center Island. And Salonika is on the tip of Center Island. And Cold Spring Harbor is here. Then Oyster Bay itself, the harbor, goes way back up here behind the island. So one of the problems with Salonika was so hard to get to. In fact, until 20 years ago, the kids used to take a launch out there from Oyster Bay, from the town of Oyster Bay, in the morning, and the launch would bring them back in the afternoon, that old Sherman Hoyt launch.
Yeah.
And then, so down here was the Cold Spring Harbor Beach Club. It never was called a yacht club. It has two white balls in the flag, in the burgee,
47?
And those are tennis balls.
Yeah.
And it was started as a beach club where the au pairs could take the kids to the beach in the 20s.
Yeah.
And my dad grew up there.
Yeah.
And then Center Island was up here. And Center Island had always been a rather spiffy place. And the beach club looks like a beach house. I mean, like a, you know, one-story house with some tennis courts and a little anchorage.
Yeah. Beach Club had no bar.
Didn't have a bar.
It had a bar.
30?
And in a way, that
was and the amount of
indifference.
The contempt and they went back and forth about that one issue. So, and because they were close to each other, they found all sorts of reasons not to get along. But the very good sailors from the Beach Club knew that you'd kind of gravitate north up there to Salonika. And my dad had done that when he was a kid, and I did that when he was a kid. And Dave Noyes never really did it. But I'm convinced that every yacht club you go to, everywhere, you will find one guy
48.
Who, with some more money or ambition or whatever, could go out and win a Bermuda race.
Hmm.
But he, for some reason, just doesn't want to.
Just not interested in making
money
or something.
Yeah, he just has other things to do, or he's got a family, or he enjoys just racing once a week, you know. You know, in some places you find two guys like that. In some places you find five of them, but you find at least one of them. So here we had this funny little beach club here and this very kind of Tony Salonika up there. It's, we perceive this arm of the New York Yacht Club
30?
Up there. And, you know, and we all knew each other, kind of, but it was this give and take about the whole thing.
Yeah.
Salonika had a lot of guys in the business because there was some money up there and people were buying boats. You'd find brokers from Sparkman Stevens, really. And Sparkman Stevens must have done well off Salonika over the years.
Well, yeah, and again, was this by design? Was this by accident?
Yeah,
who knows? Or what? Who knows? I'm not so sure there wasn't a good deal of clever thinking by Sparkman and Stevens. And the idea of when the S-boat class disappeared from Salonika, by plan, Salonika could then have had an international one design fleet, and there was some talk about it. But instead, we designed our own boat, the Salonika 21, which was not really a design success. And one of the reasons why, not all, and maybe not even controlling, was that there were people who wanted to make sure that Salonika never had a boat that wasn't designed by Sparkman Stevens. And there were Sparkman Stevens people on the board and active around the club, just like they were, you know, and I don't mean this in a vindictive or irritated or whatever sense, but, you know, the New York Yacht Club, you have that table in the middle of the dining room where all members who have nobody to eat with go and eat with each other. And S&S would always have a guy there.
Greg Sparkman had lunch there probably every day of his life.
And until the club finally put out a rule, you know, basically they broke it up. They didn't want it. It was becoming too sort of commercial. 50-30. So there may have been that kind of an overtone to what was going on. But why was that going on? Well, that was going on because Salonika was, at least up until the war, the leading edge of high-tech, world-class sailing. And so if you're a yacht designer, you want to be represented there. And furthermore, Olin was given quite a few breaks at the beginning, and I'm not sure how many. Johnny and I were talking about this on the phone the other day, but certainly Sherman Hoyt was in favor of Olin and Rod and did a few things perhaps to help him a bit. And in return, they gave him office space at S&S for years and years. And what Sherman Hoyt said about sailing was what everybody parroted at Salonika. I mean, in other words, this goes back to the establishment, and we're now up to the apex of it, and it's good old C. Sherman Hoyt, meaning no ill and having no commercial streak whatever in his veins. What did they call him? The Puck of
the
Ocean or something. I think he was called that. But in any event, that's one way you can look at it, one way you can rationalize it. Surely plenty of exceptions, other ways of looking at it, but that you're not going to go too far off that way.
Right. I once said that I wanted to be the best sailor. I was about 15.
Yeah,
I could have been.
Yeah.
And my father looked at me in a semi-Bostonian Calvinistic Episcopal and he said, look at Sherman Hoyt, he drank himself to death.
Won't
that be a lesson to you?
Right, yeah. He took many years to drink himself to death. He tried to drink himself to death.
He practiced a lot.
He practiced a lot, yeah.
And his memoirs, I'm told, were poured out of him as people were pouring gin into him at the yacht club.
Yeah, he was given a dictating machine, and he would go home and dictate it in his hotel room, and he had several secretaries who quit typing it because they couldn't stand the language. They couldn't understand it. It was totally unintelligible.
Now, he was an old Center Island family.
Yes.
Colgates and Horns.
Right.
They were
related to the Wetmores, who were one of the first purchasers of land in Salonika when it moved to Center Island from Staten Island.
Hmm.
So, I mean, you see an unbroken genealogical scheme to this thing.
Steve Colgate's in that line as well.
Yeah.
We should probably let you go. Your people are going to be back.
Oh, Johnny, wonderful stories.
I don't know what you're going to do with all of that.
We are at Communal 5. Yeah. Do we? Or what are we?
End of original recording.
5330.